expectations and living in the moment. So expectations, by definition, concern the future rather than the present moment. And our expectations of this or that event occurring or not, they can be generated as a result of like rational inquiry, you know, especially after the winter solstice. Every morning, if I happen to be in our kitchen when the sun rises, I have a nice bay window to the east that looks out over our backyard. I always carefully note where the sun's coming up, you know. And every morning, you know, as we head towards spring, I'm encouraged by the fact that, sure enough, it's rising a little further to the north every day. So that's a kind of a reason-based expectation. You know, it's been doing that for a long time, and I actually have every confidence it will continue to do so. But there are other expectations that we generate in our minds that are more often than not a result of our hopes or fears, either things that we really want to have happen or things we really hope don't happen, but expect that they might anyway. In today's Washington Post, there was this story about what some child and adolescent psychologists are calling eco-anxiety or climate depression. And to young minds that are by nature concerned about the state of the world that awaits them, it says, predictions of climate catastrophe can be even more anxiety-provoking and paralytically depressing than they are for adults. This is in part a result of some participants in the global heating debate emphasizing only the worst case scenarios and their catastrophic results. But too often, emphasizing only that can, rather than being a call to action, it can induce despair and inaction. And in that way, discourses of despair are nearly as corrosive as discourses of denial, because they both tend to result in inaction and withdrawal. And so in response, some climate educators, especially those that are teaching high school students, have really been working hard on trying to balance the information that is indeed radically concerning, you know, of what might happen, but with what steps might be taken to keep that from happening. You know, Abraham Lincoln once observed, the best way to predict the future is to create it. Step up, in other words, yeah. Get engaged. So there are these, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has generated these what are called representative climate paths, these kind of, these alternative models of how things might go in the future. There's actually an infinite variety or range of them, but there are these four paths that they've kind of singled out and given, you know, numbers to and whatnot. The one that catches all of the attention, of course, because that's the way the news media works, is the catastrophic one, you know, and that assumes things like there is going to be no change to the status quo, and that the reliance upon fossil fuels will not only continue but grow, with us doing not all that much about it. The reason that only one of those four scenarios is catastrophic is because of what, in essence, some of the social scientists and behavioral scientists, as well as the climate modelers, feel, if we were to put it in Dharma terms, is kind of a horse race between greed and fear. Which is to say that the greed of the institutional forces, you know, the commercial ones, the you know, the industrial ones, the governmental ones, the economic institutional ones that are continuing to drive the consumption of fossil fuels. Okay, really appear to have the upper hand now. But the assumption is that, and according to the modeling, and in fact it's happening faster than they predicted it would, things are going to get so bad so quickly for so many people that it is going and start inflicting such widespread suffering with the promise of much more to come, that it's actually going to pump up the fear level and the concern level to the point where it starts to overcome the greed. And the way that institutions are behaving now, it's simply not going to be deemed any longer acceptable. And we'll be looking at potential for societal breakdown, violent competition for resources around the globe, and then enough people at some point are going to say, this isn't working, and it's really time to head in a different direction. So that's actually their thought about what may well happen, which, as creepy as it sounds, is as much as anything else a cause for a certain amount of hope. It, you know, when things get bad enough, yes, in fact, we're not all going to go up in flames. We may suffer some real losses in terms of the human population, but that we probably are ultimately capable of turning it around. And the only problem with that is that in the short term right now, like when we look at the last 3 or 4 years or so, we're racing toward the catastrophic model faster than even predicted. Fossil fuel consumption continues to go up, generation of CO2 continues to go up. There is an Australian climate scientist who, during when the bushfires were at their height, said, you know, it seems to be as if my country is committing slow motion climate suicide. He said, you know, our country is literally being burned alive by the very climate fires that it has stoked through the increased exports of coal. You know, those two things can't reside indefinitely in the same political sphere. So, worst case scenarios, expectations that things may be pretty horrible now and about to get a lot more horrible than they are. Right? Whoopie ding. Happy birthday to moi. however, there's the different kinds of expectations that we can also have. And one example for me has been this recent trip that my two daughters and my wife and my older daughter's husband took to Hawaii. And it was a trip that we've been planning for many months. You know, my brother lives on the Big Island, and my mom used to as well. Her ashes are buried there. And my older daughter lived in Honolulu for several years, which is where she met her husband. And so, you know, we've had family in the islands for 40 years, and when we could afford to, you know, we've been kind of going there on a regular basis. But this is the time we'd ever traveled, you know, in this group as a family. And there were things that each of us wanted to do based on our past experiences of living and traveling in Hawaii over the years.
The mic went off.
Uh-oh. Okay. Is it back on? Okay. It goes off again. I'll just start shouting it out, I guess. There were things that each of us wanted to do based on our past experiences of living and traveling there. Whether it was a favorite hiking trail or a beach or a place to snorkel or a restaurant or just a, you know, really stunning view. So we planned this trip. It was kind of like greatest hits from all of our past trips. You know, I'm thinking, okay, so much for that. don't worry, I'll just speak out. Will you still be able to pick me up? Okay. So, so that's how we planned the trip. And we started off a few days with a few days in the Bay Area to visit friends. But by the end of that portion of our visit, I wasn't feeling well at all. and the day we left to fly to Hawaii, I had come down with a full-blown head and chest cold. You know, I was starting to run a fever and my body ached and I had a headache. And every time, like taking off from Honolulu, from Oakland and landing in Honolulu and taking off from there to fly over to the Big Island, my ears would just, it was like people were sticking, you know, ice picks in. It was like, hurt really, really bad. And so, welcome to Hawaii. And by the time we got to where we were going, you know, the rest of the family is planning, well, what should we do over the next couple of days? And they're going to go shop for groceries. And all I wanted to do was crawl in bed and die, you know. So I spent most of the next 2 days in bed, more horizontal than vertical. My wife caught the same cold the day after that, and then followed by my younger daughter. So we were not happy campers, right? My older daughter and husband had already had it. Okay. So by day four, I was well enough to go on short walks, and we went to a nice restaurant where we'd enjoyed being before. And after a really long wait, we were told it was going to be another half hour before our food would be ready after we'd ordered. And the food turned out to be terrible, and the service was lousy. And next day I determined that I was going to go snorkeling at this bay in South Kohala where I'd really had wonderful experiences in the past, you know, swimming in the coral reefs and all the colorful fish and the turtles and the eels and all that good stuff. This time was the water was kind of opaque and rough. You know, I talk about imagining the breathing to be like the surface of the ocean on a calm day. This is like the surface of the ocean if you had a bad cough, you know, which I did. But I swam out there anyway, and I got out into the ocean a ways and realized that whenever I tried to swim full speed, you know, following fish or whatever, I couldn't breathe because my breathing was too compromised, and I couldn't get enough oxygen through my snorkel tube. So I had to turn around and start swimming back to shore, and every once in a while I have to stick my head above water like a seal or something and gasp for air so I could keep going until I got back. So much for the snorkeling, right? And then finally, later on in the trip, the Dharma caught up with me. You know, it's happily, you know, been at this for more than 40 years now, it finally started to kick in. And I realized that all that I had been doing all this time leading up to the trip was creating these expectations for future experiences in Hawaii based on years of memories of the past. Okay. And instead, for me, every day, at least during the first part of the trip, it was like going outside and walking into a minefield, you know, and having one expectation or another blow up in my face because what I wanted to happen or hoped would happen was not going to happen until I finally had to, you know, face the reality of what I was actually experiencing, you know, which started with not feeling well, which is not something I had certainly not planned into the trip, right? It kind of reminded me of that parable of the Mullah Nasruddin about the miserable traveler, you know, and how terrible he feels about everything that's going on until Nasruddin robs him and then he later gets all his stuff back. Finally, when I had that insight, I was able to let go of what I wanted or expected to happen next. And then start just focusing on what was really going on without too much attachment or aversion. So I had a chance to reflect a little on the privilege and good fortune that allowed us to go on this trip in the first place, whether I was sick or not. During the time that we were staying on the Big Island, we were near this place where there was this nice sort of lagoon, and there were all these birds that would come and hang out there. And so since I couldn't move around much. Anyway, I did have my binoculars in my Hawaii bird book, so I was able to really study the wildlife in a way I hadn't before. I learned a lot more and really came to appreciate the birds more than I had before. And then after that, when I was feeling a bit better, we spent some time over on Oahu, in Honolulu. We visited this place, this workplace of a good friend of my daughter's when she had lived there. And this person had been in management at the Whole Foods grocery chain for the islands. And she was the one who was responsible for sourcing all of the locally grown produce and commodities and all the different, you know, forms of food that are actually created in Hawaii, and making sure that the Whole Food Market stocked a lot of that, as much of that stuff as they could. And now she was a development director for a pretty good size, or a foundation that owned this pretty good size organic vegetable farm on the far west end of the island of Hawaii, where it's, or of Oahu, where it's kind of hot and dry, and it's probably the least affluent part of the island. And in addition to running this this organic farm that not only sold to Whole Foods, but also to most of the high-end local restaurants, because growing food like this really isn't all that cheap. And they also ran this, in partnership with local educational institutions, they also ran this program to train local young people, college-age young people, in the principles of sustainable food production, management, and marketing. Okay, something to think about. You visit Hawaii sometime. A century ago, roughly, the islands were basically self-sustaining when it came to growing the food that they ate and local food production. As a result of the explosive growth on the islands since World War II, if all transportation sources to the islands were to be cut off, the islands of Hawaii would cease being food secure in about 10 days. eventually, starvation would start to set in, right? Not good for the human population. A lot of the other life, you know, forms of life probably didn't care that much. Yeah, they're going to do okay, especially the ones that eat carrion, but not us. So this farm and its educational enterprise, they represent the beginning of a kind of a revival or a reversal of this trend in Hawaii, at least starting back in the direction of making the islands more self-sustaining and more food secure. So visiting this farming operation and its educational programs and whatnot, for me, it was actually quite inspiring, you know, and encouraging, because I'm doing similar work here in Denver, assisting in efforts to kind of re-green low-income minority neighborhoods that have been turned into industrial wastelands by government agencies and pretty much left for dead. And so now we're seeking to do the same thing in terms of originating tree canopies and getting into local food production and things of that nature, really trying to help heal old wounds and make for a brighter, more sustaining future. So, and now looking back on it, now that I feel better, although I've still got a little bit of a cold, there was this real Dharma teaching in there about the extent to which my attachment to expectations for how I wanted that trip to be caused a lot of dukkha, you know, caused a lot of dissatisfaction with how things actually are. Okay. It's still a transcendentally beautiful and inspiring place to go to. And it was warm and sunny. And I did come to have a greater appreciation of nature there than I even had before. I came to see that there were really important, constructive, creative things going on in terms of kind of from the ground up people's willingness and energy to make a better life for themselves and for the planet. And so once I was able to let go and take in what was there, turns out there was some pretty neat stuff there, right? So every February since I retired, I try to spend at least half my birthday month in Tucson, which is where I grew up, from early childhood to adulthood. Okay. And since so I spent about half every month there ever since I retired 3 years ago. So I have this expectation of warmth and sunshine, right? Well, then I remembered as a kid, you know, it's still true, Tucson has two rainy seasons. There's a brief one that happens around January, February, a little bit of March, and then there's another really, you know, violent, horrendous one that happens starting in late July into early September, you know, the summer monsoons, right? And there were actually times when I was a kid, lived in the Tucson Mountains west of town, you know, when there'd be a dusting of snow on my birthday. And there was one year the temperature when I got up that morning was 25 degrees. 2 years ago, one of my, you know, greatest and sweetest expectations. Well, they grew up and went to school in the barrio in West Tucson, and there's this legendary Mexican delicatessen called the El Grande Tortilla Factory. Everybody in West Tucson knows that's where you went. You know, it's the best, most authentic Sonoran Mexican food to be found in southern Arizona. So I went over there, you know, just like I did every time I'd come to town to visit relatives. You know, I was going to get a dozen or so of different kinds of tamales and Spanish rice, which they call, you know, refrieds and tortillas and stuff. And of course, it's close. Yeah, and then run by the family of some guys I knew in high school, and they said, you know, last time I was there, they said, you're getting worn out, and no one in the family wants to take it on. So another expectation down the old tubes. So, and I'm expecting to go out and hike in the desert mountains like I always have. I'll be hiking alone though this time, and the desert is a desert, and the desert mountains in southern Arizona are a place that really is like mindfulness is not optional. It's a little different than, you know, hiking somewhere, you know, in one of the parks up in the foothills, you know. Because there are things out there, and again, not to take it personally, but there are things out there that don't have your best interests at heart. And if you mess with them, they will mess with you, you know. So in hiking, I do my best not to get, you know, nailed by a rattlesnake or scorpion or whatever, but, you know, stuff happens. The real estate developers in the San Pedro Valley have sliced and diced every square inch of private property, and they continue to do so. The only thing that keeps them from consuming the entire landscape is all the federal land around the city. And well, I remember when I came home from Vietnam, or 4 days after I left Vietnam, I was in Tucson registering at the University of Arizona. It's kind of an abrupt transition. I flew home at night in the summer, and when the doors to the plane opened, it's a kind of a bush in the Sonoran Desert called the creosote bush, and when it rains in the summertime, it puts out this unmistakable fragrance that just sort of bowls you over. One of my college friends, Gary Nabhan, an ethnobotanist, wrote a book a few years ago called "The Desert Smells Like Rain," and that's what he was talking about. So that's when I knew I was home. You know, I felt that fragrance wash over me. And the next morning when I got up here in Tucson, Catalina Mountains were to the north and the Rincons to the east and Santa Rita's to the south. The Tucson Mountains where I grew up were to the west. And that was home, you know. And a friend of mine from Navajo told me that there's a place on the Navajo reservation where American Indians in general have much higher participation rates in the U.S. military than any other ethnic group. And so he told me there was this one place when Navajo military members who were getting ready to go abroad to fight someplace, they would take him to this particular valley there. And they would say, you know, this is the place where warriors in your tribe from time immemorial have come to be blessed before they went forth, and their spirits reside here now. We're blessing you now, and your spirits will always be here, whatever happens to you in battle. So when I got up the next morning, I looked around at those mountain ranges and realized that the same was true for me. You know, there's a part of me that had never left, and there's a part of me that will always be there. So it's a really meaningful place for me. And so those expectations, the mountains are still going to be there, and the sun's still going to come up over the Rincons, and it's still going to go down over the Tucson Mountains. And those are reason-based expectations. You know, whether my favorite restaurant's going to be there, or, you know, what my experience out hiking is going to be. I mean, that stuff comes and goes. What it all comes down to, and I really am bringing this back around to the Dharma, is that when we're living, really living in the moment, one of the things that we can do is be mindful of our expectations, you know, just as something to look at, you know, and look to the extent that, you know, what experience we actually do have is tinged by the kind of experience that we wanted to have. You know, that was certainly the case for me, you know, when we were in Hawaii. It took me about half the trip to let go of the fact that I was not going to have the trip I had planned to have. Okay? And that once that became evident, that's what made the kind of the falling away possible. That's what made the letting go possible. That's what made it possible to just kind of be in the moment. So the insight, the mindfulness helps us to really kind of come and see what the substance of our expectations are and the extent to which they may be getting in the way or actually being able to live life in the moment. And when you can do that, the insight, the mindfulness creates the foundation for the cultivation and the arising of equanimity, which is the ability to just kind of be with things as they are. You know, the Buddha taught it as a foundational state of mind or quality of the heart mind that allows us to experience the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows without either attachment or aversion. So, right now our equanimity is certainly being tested in these times of political travail, right? There are, the hopes and fears are being stoked for what may or may not happen in the future. And whether it's that or something more personal about whether to begin a relationship or end a relationship or start a job or end a job or keep practicing the Dharma or not, you know. To some extent, that's all based on expectations, which is different from simply being in the moment. And once again, you know, for me, I've finally figured out that being in the moment is where the freedom lies. letting go into what is, and then working with that skillfully. It's possible to skillfully and compassionately and, you know, look at our current situation, take compassionate action when it feels like it might be warranted, to do nothing when it seems like it might not be. It's possible, and it's important, because that is where the freedom lies. Let's talk. Anything, anybody hear anything familiar in there? Comment, question?
I did read not so long ago that if the city of Tucson lost power in the sun, and so people's freezing, that Tucson has 3 days worth of food in warehouses and grocery stores. So if there was a problem with transportation or something,
people who, and this is actually true of us, because we lived in the mountains outside of Tucson when I was a little kid. And furthermore, we were far enough back up into the Tucson mountains that in the summer monsoons, when they'd really come ripping through, you know, 30,000 foot thunderheads and these, you know, these spears of Thor, you know, striking the landscape left, right, and center. We would have these monstrous flash floods. Like if it rained at night, you could wake up in the morning and there was this dull roar like a freight train. And the dirt road that we took to get to the main road went down through one of these arroyos. And there were a few times when we were living out there, when you wake up in the morning and you hear this roaring sound, you see these, this huge rush of muddy brown water tearing along through the arroyo at like 25 miles an hour, and there'd be boulders, and there'd be tree trunks, and there'd be an occasional dead cow or something. I mean, these are really horrible, violent, you know, flash flood. People get killed in them, you know, drowned in their cars in them periodically. And they also dropped about 5 tons of silt right in the middle of our road, and we weren't going anywhere. And so even back then, we always had, I don't know, maybe a week's worth of canned food in the house, you know. And so people that really understand how the environment works down there tend to as well. it's the extent to which we have become so entirely dependent on a really fragile infrastructure. You know, those are the things that people would just soon not think about because it's kind of creepy. Yeah. And we may be entering a time when the infrastructure is going to continue to demonstrate its fragility. Either because just natural stuff happens or because somebody decides that they want to give us a hard time. I'm not urging everyone to go out and become a survivalist, but just to be sensitive to the fact that we live a more fragile existence than we know. And it's worth attending to, and for that reason also doing what we can to start moving toward greater sustainability. Yeah. And more reliance on less. Okay, thank you. Other stuff. Please, go ahead.
I've always had a difficult time navigating, and I have an easier time referring to it as that space and the serenity prayer between the acceptance of things I can't change and the courage to change the things I can.
Yes.
So these days, especially as a political activist, it's harder to know to whom I'm letting go.
Thank you. Well said, well said. To whom are we letting go? We're letting go, basically, in Buddha Dharma, to things as they are. One of the things that I tremendously appreciate the Reinhold Niebuhr's gift of that prayer, of that blessing, of that thought. The place where I found myself kind of finding some point that I was not really using that teaching all that skillfully is that I had decided that those three things were static. That there are those things you can change and there are those things you cannot change, and you need to figure out what the difference is between them all. My own view now, and it's as informed by the Dharma, is that things are very dynamic. All three of those are moving targets. You know, that, and to some extent, they're all maybe just a little bit illusory. You know, maybe sometimes thinking that we can change that we cannot, thinking that we cannot change things that we actually can, you know? And so the wisdom to know the difference isn't necessarily seeing this fixed thing and that fixed thing and being able to distinguish between the two. The wisdom is being able to understand the dynamic, you know, between those things we think or thought we could change and those things we think or thought we could not, that sometimes one can morph into another, you know. And the other way I think that I was limited in my own understanding of the prayer at first was that I was only thinking about me, you know. What can I change? And then because mostly that's directed at oneself and understanding oneself. What can I change about me? What can I not change about me? Is there really such a thing? You know, are there really things about myself I cannot change? Are there really things about myself I can change? You know, and so, and then we take it even deeper in the Dharma. It's like, who changes and who can't change? You know. Because as in the understanding of the Dharma, we ourselves are fluid, you know. And so for me, working with the Serenity Prayer now is like a mindfulness exercise in some ways. What appears to be susceptible to change? There were things about myself I thought were immutable and that I could never do anything about, until I really got deeply involved in the Dharma and just realized how fluid everything was and how these things about myself I thought I could not change, I had classified as such because at some level there were things I didn't want to change. Right? And yet all of a sudden, things freed up. Wow, okay, there are things about myself I didn't think I could change that I can. There were things about myself, I'm going to quit smoking tomorrow. I'm going to quit drinking tomorrow. I've quit hundreds of times, right? Shouldn't be a problem, right? Turns out that it is, you know? Things that I thought I could just change tomorrow with the flick of a switch, maybe not so much. Maybe those roots go really, really deep, and maybe it's going to take a really long time for there to be any meaningful change, you know? For me, rather than those things being fixed and immutable, there are things that invite attention, you know, that invite care. Is that responsive? Is that helpful?
Yeah, so that's where the practice comes in. And I found that since moving over from a 12-step focus to a Dharma focus,
yes,
that, it's taken the place of meditation. Meditation has been the power to which I've turned my will and my life.
Of course, right. Absolutely. I mean, because what we're talking about right now is the incredible healing power of the Dharma. It's it's in there, you know? And you can hear the words and, well, that's nice, but until you actually give it a try and practice it, whoa, okay, that's interesting. All these things I thought about myself are not carved in stone. They're worthy of re-examination. They're worthy of working with. And I think that, and that's just kind of the observational, the insight part. I think that one of the things that I also would tend to forget that has become increasingly important for me over the years is that it really has to be done with great compassion, you know, for oneself and for others. You know, Ram Dass once, you know, he made this comment, I think, in a conversation with Joseph Goldstein or Jack Kornfield, one or the other. He said, to do this practice properly is to watch the mind with the heart.
Yeah. I'm sorry, watch the
mind. Is to watch the mind with the heart. You know, and in fact, language being what it is in the holy languages of India, there's this word chitta, or chitta, and it means heart mind. That's how it's translated, because they don't differentiate the two. It's both together. Yeah. So the cultivation of bodhicitta, as it's called in the Dharma traditions, is the cultivation of the heart mind of the bodhisattva. You know, that's actually what's happening on an ongoing basis when we do this work. Yeah. Thanks, Gloria. Please.
Yeah, I have experienced quite a bit in doing this practice, letting go of self-concepts that I thought were just pretty much set in stone. And it's been pretty interesting. You know, it's not anything I thought would happen, but it's just been happening in spite of myself. And the difficulty is the uncertainty. I mean, I don't know. I imagine other people have experienced that, but, you know, letting go of old self-concepts, then suddenly there, at least I experienced a fair amount of uncertainty about,
yes,
okay, so what am I going to grab onto now?
Yes. That is a really important hallmark or characteristic of deepening Dharma practice and understanding. The Thai forest meditation master, Ajahn Chah, from whose lineage I've been trained, one of his mantras that he would, you know, have his followers repeat, including the monastics that were training with him, and especially the monastics, I guess maybe, was simply, you know, when someone would, they would be discussing the Dharma and they had this really kind of fervent, faith-based understanding of the Dharma and how it worked. And the mantra he would tell them to repeat was, not sure. Not sure. That it's great to investigate the Dharma and see what seems to be working for you and what seems to be true, as long as you don't cling to it. And so that is subtle, because, you know, and like Thanissaro Bhikkhu says, you know, it's not as if you can stop clinging at the flick of a switch or as soon as you read some Dharma book or other. He said a lot of early Dharma practice is learning to become more strategic in our clinging. Yeah, so we start clinging to the idea of being an enlightened being, right? Instead of being the master of the universe or, you know, the Nobel Prize recipient or something. But so we start navigating by different, you know, metrics. And yet, that not sure, you know, who do I really want to become? What is wrong with how I am now, right? That I want to change, that I want to be different than I am now. And then, if you're really following the Dharma, the next step there is to say, let's have a look at this question based on my feeling that I'm not good enough as I am now. Yeah. what is it about who I consider myself to be now that I don't like or that I want to get rid of or that I want to change, you know? What is the nature of that aversion to complete acceptance of the totality of who I am in the moment?
Yeah. Including the, you know, the uncertainty. Accepting
that the Buddha might be right in the idea that there is no permanent and abiding self, that we are recreating ourselves on a moment-to-moment basis, but that if we're doing it within the context of the Dharma, as that continuous rebirthing process occurs, it's not happening in isolation somewhere out in the universe. It's happening within a context, mind state, a field of compassion and selfless joy and self-love and equanimity. So even though, kind of like a cloud chamber, right? So even though the notion of a hard, constructed, unchanging self is gone, this process by which the continuous reconstruction or the continuous rebirthing of self occurs is happening within this, what's called sometimes a Dharma field or a Dharma container, okay? Happening within these, what's also called the divine abidings, that the consciousness is abiding in this field even as the uncertainty over who we think we are continues to occur. So there is indeed the uncertainty, and there is indeed this Dharma field within which the uncertainty is being experienced, which is what makes it possible to experience that level of uncertainty.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, you had your hand up.
That's right.
Okay. Anything else? Well then, oh please.
It's sort of back to how you started with expectations, uncertainty and expectations, lack of expectations, that somehow if you participate in the Dharma and you come and meditate and expect that it's going to be a certain way, it's going to provide a certain peace or tranquility or equanimity, you may be surprised.
Exactly.
And so expectations don't work with the Dharma either, really. You just have to bring to it what's here right now, and that's you want. I want some predictability, and I realize I can't have the predictability that I would like.
Right. Which is a source of ta-da, dukkha, right? Source of suffering.
So there has to be some kind of relaxation into softening those expectations.
Yes. Right. Equanimity in this instance comes from being able to observe your expectations with compassion. You know, especially to the extent to which they may be expectations to which you're either attached or aversive. Yeah. And you can say, oh, here's the mind entertaining expectations.
Just don't take it too seriously.
Because it's an expectation of something that may happen in the future rather than what's happening in the moment. Yeah. Good, thank you. And thank you all for wishing me a happy birthday. And may you have a safe journey home this evening, as I will endeavor to do as well. Let's take our sitting postures just for one last minute if we can. As we go forth this evening, may we be safe from all inner and outer harm. May we live with ease and know ease of well-being. May we reside in equanimity, at peace with things as they are. in this eternal moment. Safe journey home.